Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear Danny Ortiz.
And so I did the very logical thing of handwriting a 17-page single-space erotic fiction about the two of us.
That and more. But first, I am deep into this course I've been taking on International Coaching Federation-style coaching, and it is sometimes overwhelming. And it is sometimes so enlightening, sometimes so inspiring. I've begun to learn that the more I practice unconditional positive regard for my clients, the more I'm able to give that gift to myself as well. I've learned that the more curious I am about potential and possibility in other people's lives, the more my own neural pathways seem to be shape-shifting. So I want to record a conversation between myself and my dear friend Adam Griffin, who took this same course and is now a certified coach, and put it on Patreon soon. But in the meantime, if you are interested in my coaching services, email me to ask about it at kevin@risk-show.com.
We'll be right back.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Now here's the show. Folks, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and this is Dargs and Moses Boyd behind me now, and we're calling this week's episode Dreaming of You. Dreams of desire and haunting ones. Hey, folks, last week we gave you something special. A third episode, three episodes in 1 week. That one was called Outrage with Don Jewel Fraser, and you might have noticed it was a story recorded in a slightly different way, where Don told the story to me in conversation, and we chatted about it along the way. I want to know what you thought of that. First, what you thought of having three episodes in 1 week, and what you thought of that style of episode. I am at kevin@risk-show.com. We have the Risk Podcast Fans discussion group on Facebook, and our subreddit is Risk Podcast. Now, in a little bit, we're going to hear from Sam D, but before that, a story from Danny Ortiz, recorded at the Risk Live show at the Lyric Hyperion in LA in February. Here's Danny now with a story we call Subliminal Messaging.
Mm-hmm.
sitting over here, staring in your face with a lust in my eyes. Sure, you don't give a damn, and you don't know that I've been dreaming of you in my fantasies. So began Janet Jackson's song, If, one of my favorite songs of all time. It is a song about a very strong desire for a man that is off limits to her. And that is unfortunate for both of them because they would both be better off if only they could be together. And as the only out gay boy in my high school at 17 in the late 90s, I got this song. I had come out to family and some friends when I was 12. So there had been 5 years by my senior year of high school of knowing what I wanted and having no access to it. Socially, romantically, experimentally, nothing. All of my thoughts of boys were from the school that I went to and had to be kept in my boy ranking journal. Which was also known as my yearbook. Beside the names of boys that I had little crushes or things on, I had a star system. They earned 1, 2, or 3 stars. And the basic breakdown is this. 1 star. I've seen you. You look good. I've not really met you. You might be in a different year. You might be a friend of a friend. Very often you are the brother of a friend. 2 stars. They were the most 2-star boys. 2-star boys were, we've had some classes together. We've perhaps participated in an activity. I've seen you up close. I've seen you from different angles. Maybe we did a group project that one time. I may not like your personality, but I know you have one. And that was 2-star. And then there was the very rare 3-star rating. 3 stars were, yes, you look good. But also, in a different circumstance, like I could maybe see us together. This was a bona fide crush. And perhaps the most 3-star of 3-star boys was Aaron. And where I was short and kind of skinny and I had a big puff of frizzy hair, Aaron was tall. He played a sport. He was in clubs. He said smart things in class. Actually, we had that in common. But other than that, and his shoulders were broader than his waist, so he had that like taper thing happening. And if you wore a button shirt and the top 2 buttons were undone, there were visible chest hairs. And I emphasize hairs, plural hairs. But most importantly, the best thing about Aaron was that Aaron was nice to me because, as the only out kid in school, and I was not just gay. Like, I had a favorite music video, and it was Janet Jackson's If, and I not only knew the iconic choreography, but I could tell you the choreographer and makeup artist's names. It was Tina Langdon and Kevin O'Quinn, in case you were wondering. So I was like, I was gay to the point of any guy who might hang out with me was perhaps gay by association. And so I didn't have a lot of guy friends, but Aaron was friendly. And he was also really hot. I just want to be clear. He was so hot. Janet Jackson's If lyrics. How many nights I've laid in bed excited over you. I've thought of us 100 different ways. I've gotten there so many times. I wonder, how about you? Day and night, night and day. And so all of my sexual thoughts and notions had to exist in my head and in my hands. These were the options. And in the late 90s, pre-internet at home, except maybe if you just got the AOL 80-hour promotional CD-ROM, I had to rely, as most of us did, on imagination, on shirtless scenes, on WB teen soap operas, and then, of course, on Ricky Martin scrapbooks, where we collected every single picture from any magazine, English, Spanish, or who knows what language, carefully cut, pasted, and arranged just so. Right? We all, you know, all of us, right? Yeah. And then, there were occasionally wet dreams, nocturnal emissions. Those were few and far between because that took a few weeks of buildup, and 17-year-old boys aren't really the best at waiting weeks to release fluids and desires. But they happen sometimes. And one morning, I remember waking up from an extremely vivid dream about Tony Robbins, the motivational speaker with videotapes on how you could lose weight, get money, and be fulfilled in every aspect of your life. And I will clarify, because I may have misled you a little bit, it was not a sexual dream. It was just extremely vivid. I felt like I was with him. Nothing of note happened, but he was there. And it felt real in that way that dreams do. And I didn't think much of it. It was a fluke. Until not very long after, the same thing happened again, but with Richard Simmons. And I started thinking, like, wait, this just happened. Like, what was going on? And then it occurred to me that as I was stirring and remembering being in the room with Richard Simmons, there was an infomercial playing on the TV that I had fallen asleep watching for his Sweat Into the Oldies. And looking back, there had been an infomercial for Tony Robbins' motivational tapes. And so it became clear that they were invading my subconscious. They were infiltrating my dreams. And I thought, wait a second. This is just like that episode of Saved by the Bell, where Zach learns about subliminal messaging, and he puts a coded message to Kelly, who he wants to invite him to the sweetheart dance, that she wants to invite him to the sweetheart dance, playing under a mixtape of a song that she loves. And it backfires, hijinks ensue. But I thought, wait a second. Subliminal messaging, vivid dreams, wet dreams. If I could not be with Aaron in real life, I could force myself to have a sexy dream about him. And so I did the very logical thing of handwriting a 17-page single-spaced erotic fiction about the two of us. And, you know, they say, write what you know, write what you love. So I set it at my favorite restaurant, a romantic little spot. You may have heard of it, Sizzler. The basic plot of this fiction was that I was working at Sizzler, which, by the way, I loved because as a kid, I thought because it was a salad bar that it was free. And that's why it was my favorite restaurant. But also that garlic cheese bread was really good. I say was because I believe that there are no more open anymore. We'll take a moment. Okay. I was working at Sizzler and I was closing up for the night by myself. And I was, as I was finishing clearing the last tables, who should I stumble upon sitting at a booth in the back, unbeknownst to anyone else on the staff, but Aaron? Now, I like to think that I would have had the foresight to have him sitting there waiting for me to finish my shift, but I genuinely think that in the plot of the story, it was just a coincidence. He happened to be there, and in the 17 pages, single-spaced, handwritten on a legal pad that I wrote, I don't think we even took our pants off. What I wanted was shirtless, body-to-body contact, and for both of us to want to be there. That was the fantasy. And so at the conclusion of the story, I was a very good server that night. And after finishing the story, I took the next logical step of recording myself reading it on an audio cassette that I could then play every night to put that dream right on in there. And I did this night after night after night, going on weeks, and I was really trying to exercise restraint because I knew that I needed the desires to build, to make it happen. And, you know, every now and then I had to reset that clock because, you know, Ricky Martin had a new music video on TRL or a two-star boy was at swim practice, you know? And so I just kept going, weeks at a time, then months at a time, listening every night, putting in my headphones, because of course I could not have my mom or dad passing my bedroom and hearing this story every single night. And I had really planned ahead. I recorded an hour of blank space before I started so I could be good and in that like deep state of sleep so it would really get in the dreams. And after months of listening to this tape, every single night without fail, I gave up because my foolproof plan did not work. And I realized that that is an anticlimactic ending. Believe me, I am very acquainted with the fact that that is an anticlimactic ending. But after school, I moved to bigger cities like San Francisco and then New York, and I got to have some shirtless body-to-body contact and a few other things that Janet Jackson's saying about in that song that we didn't even get to. If you're not familiar, just listen. It's a good one. And internet became available to us all in our living rooms and in our pockets. And with the advent of social media, I have, out of pure curiosity, been able to check up and see, you know, just how is Aaron doing? How is Aaron doing? And how is Aaron looking? And I can tell you from photos that he has posted from beach trips with his wife and kids, I was not wrong. There are some of those stars that I do not know what I was thinking, but I got it right with Aaron. And I will share with you the chorus to If, which really summed up kind of how I looked at him then and how grown man me looked at grown man him. If I was your girl, the things I'd do to you, I'd make you call out my name. I'd ask who it belongs to. That is so good. That is so good. If I was your woman, oh, the things I'd do to you. But I'm not, so I can't, then I won't. But if I was your girl,
anticipated WNBA season in history.
So you know what that means.
Court is back in session with Queens of the Court, a WNBA podcast.
I'm your girl, Cheryl Swoops.
And I'm Jordan Robinson. All WNBA season long, we'll bring you interviews with star athletes, analysis on your favorite teams,
and lots of hot takes.
Order in the court.
Follow and listen to Queens of the Court, free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Risk. This is George Benson behind me now with Breezin', a classic with an especially dreamy beginning. And we just heard from Janet Jackson, who followed Danny Ortiz, but our producer Hope Brush included no subliminal messaging underneath the audio of his story, and you're just gonna have to take my word for that. By the way, Danny has an absolutely fabulous story in the absolutely fabulous book, Welcome to Queendom, also featuring stories by Risk storytellers Calvin S. Cato, Philip Markle, Jamie Brickhouse, and me. Super fun reading for Pride Month this year. So go get Welcome to Queendom. Folks, one of our Patreon patrons, Coco Park, recently sent us this note with their donation. Risk has provided me years of guilty enjoyment. Not guilty as in guilty pleasure, guilty as in I wasn't in a position to support you financially. Now that I can, I've signed up to Patreon and will now have years of guilt-free, feel-good listening. Thanks for all the entertainment over the years. Here's to many, many more. Thank you so much, Coco. Listen, the Apple iOS change this year just devastated the whole podcasting industry, basically. Even This American Life lost one-third of its download numbers. One of the podcast networks lost $12 million almost overnight. So a show like this, with so many moving parts, so many employees, we need all the help we can possibly get just to last another year. But there's so much for our supporters at patreon.com/risk, like this week's bonus story by Jonah Ray.
I wake up in the middle of the night and I don't want to open my eyes because I feel that Candyman is right above me. And I try to scream for help. I want to say, and then I hear in the other room, Madonna sing this song about this lost youth and this thing that isn't anymore. And then I'm angry at my brother for not being there and for making Candyman show up and want to kill me and watching League of Their Own without me, not waiting till the next day. It's like, it's too much new stuff. And I wet my bed.
And there's plenty more where that came from at patreon.com/risk. Now, next, we're going to hear from Sam D, a beautifully told story that Sam worked on with our producer, Taj Easton. Here's Sam D now with a story we call Sundowning.
It was the summer after seventh grade, and my tormentors were in the rear view. I was excited to finally start reading the Harry Potter I just got and to watch the Powerpuff Girls, but my summer plans had been decided for me. I was standing there getting ready to undress my great-grandma Helen to help her get in the shower. She was very nervous and didn't like people looking at her, especially after she had had her mastectomy, not even doctors. And I had to help her into the shower, and she kept accusing me of looking at her, saying, "Stop looking at me, stop looking at me." And I turned around, assuring her that I wasn't looking at her, and put space between us and turned around and just waited there silently as she was crying and getting into the shower herself. And I can only imagine what she was feeling, having to be helped into a shower. I just was there for what felt like hours, listening and wishing that I was riding my bike to go get a Yoo-hoo like any other 12-year-old was doing, instead of taking care of their 78-year-old grandmother. My great-grandmother's name was Helen, and her dementia had gotten to the point where she could no longer take care of herself and moved in with my grandma, Maggie, who was her daughter. We were very poor, so this was the only option for her. And my grandma, Maggie, already had two jobs and was struggling, so she asked my mom if I could go for 2 weeks to help her with the around-the-clock care that my great-grandma Helen needed. Someone always needed to be with her. And so my mom told her yes and made it seem like my duty, because to her, family was everything. If we needed them, they'd be there for us. And if they needed us, we'd be there for them. She also likened it to babysitting, which I was very used to being the oldest of seven kids. And I hated babysitting, so that didn't really soften the blow. I wanted to be left alone, listening to my Discman drawing Sailor Moon. But this is what I had to do with my summer. I also, at the same time, had a Tamagotchi, the little virtual pet that has a few buttons on it, and it's as big as a keychain. And I would forget about that for days at a time and open it back up and it would be dying and surrounded by pixelated poop. And yet I was being tasked with practically nursing someone quadruple my age. More than that. While I was there, I was often mistaken for a boy because I had this ill-gotten bull haircut. We had had lice, and my mom thought if she cut off all my hair that they wouldn't come back. And my great-grandma Helen often referred to me as the boy and would tell my grandma Maggie, get the boy out of the house. It's after dark. Like it was some boyfriend after curfew. And we would both try to explain, I'm your great-granddaughter, Samantha, but that doesn't have any effect. And knowing now more about dementia, you're not supposed to correct anyone if they make a mistake. It confuses them and agitates them. She was often confused and agitated and would try to leave when she would feel that way. And once she successfully did leave the house and was brought back by police, she had no shoes on and her feet were bleeding. And it was very heartbreaking to see that, especially at that age. She just encapsulated the phrase, the lights are on, but nobody's home. She would sit in this rocking chair in the living room for hours, just rocking, not saying anything, looking off into nothing. And those were considered good days. And on bad days, she would be in the kitchen, washing dishes that weren't there and mumbling to herself and just very erratic. It felt like being in a haunted house, but the ghost was still carrying around its body. To make things worse, there were only two bedrooms in that house that my grandma Maggie and my great-grandma Helen both occupied, so I was relegated to the couch, and it was an old lady couch, white, floral, hard upholstery with buttons puckering every few inches, and it made sleeping practically impossible. There's this thing called sundowning with dementia, where it gets very confusing when they can't tell what time it is, and it happens especially at like sundown or night because it's very disorienting when they wake up and they think it's supposed to be a certain time and it isn't. On one of the bad nights, I heard her stirring late at night and listened, and she came out into the living room, and because I was still afraid of the dark at the time, I had left the bathroom light on and could see that she was completely naked and walking out into the living room, and I didn't know what to do, and I didn't want to upset her by letting her know I could see her or that I was even there. And she just started calling out, Thelma, Thelma. And I laid there just facing the back of the couch, hoping she didn't notice me, just completely paralyzed as she was just yelling. She was calling her dead sister's name in the middle of the night. And finally, my grandma Maggie came out and helped her get back to bed. And I just laid there feeling like a coward and thinking in hindsight, I should have tried to help her back, but I probably would have made it worse. But just laying there didn't feel right either. And I was just always caught in those situations where it felt like no matter what I did, it would have ended the same way. It was always going to end with her being upset. The only time I had interacted with my great-grandma before all of this was a few Christmases before. My mom forced me to go sit with her on the couch. Nobody was anywhere near her because she, even before that, was not a very friendly woman. And so I went and I sat next to her and tried to make conversation, and I would say things like, so, what's your favorite animal? And she'd say, animals are disgusting. And then I asked, oh, okay, well, what's your favorite color? And she said, well, I'm blind. So making conversations with her didn't work, and I would just sit there in silence and wait for dinner to be ready. And that was really the longest interaction I ever had with my great-grandma, because even when we went to visit her, I would be off playing with something else while my grandma and my mom would talk, and my great-grandma would be puttering around doing something else. So interactions between her and I were practically non-existent before this. But it wasn't always bad. They had this massive attic with all of their old stuff and clothes, and my great-grandma had all of these, like, clothes from the 70s, like a faux fur coat and costume jewelry that I would dress up with. One day in the attic, I had found a bag of water balloons, and I was so excited to go downstairs and fill them up. And after I did, I realized I have no one to throw these at. And so I improvised and tied them all together and drew faces on them and then play-acted dramas and love triangles. And they were just these, like, floppy, bizarre water dolls because I had nothing else to play with. And then I set the rest of the balloons down on the kitchen counter to play with later and went to watch more TV. And the next day, my mom had come and picked me up. I was so excited to be going home. And on the way back, I eventually asked her, why am I going home so early? The time wasn't over yet. She just solemnly said that great-grandma Helen was found in immense pain and taken to the hospital, where they discovered that there was a blockage in her colon that led to sepsis, and she had died. It turned out that she had ingested the rest of the bag of balloons, not knowing, and they killed her. And I didn't say anything else for the rest of the ride home, because I just was in shock and couldn't believe something as simple as leaving balloons, something so obviously not food, could be confused by her. I felt scared and wondered if everybody knew and blamed me. It was just, it's hard to even describe the feelings, because it was just such a mixture of so many different things, because I wanted to go home. I wanted to be free to do what I wanted to do. And I thought all the time, I wish my grandma Maggie didn't have to deal with all of this, having to watch her mother just slowly disappear in front of her. It felt like I had gotten what I'd wished for, and it was like a monkey paw wish. At her funeral, I was asked to read out of the Bible, which reminded me of one of my first memories with Helen. I was just learning to read and was asked to read a passage out of the Bible for her, and she clapped her hands after I got through it. And it was really the only positive memory I have with her. And here I was standing next to her urn under bright fluorescent lights with everyone in my family staring up at me. And I just had no idea what anyone was thinking or feeling or anything, and just felt like I was being put on the spot, like in judgment, especially in a church. And I stumbled through the words on stage as quickly as I could and got off. And I just cried so much that day, but it was mostly for myself, more so than what had happened, because I felt selfish and careless and just that I was such a terrible person. Even though it was unintentional, I was directly responsible for her death. As much as I wanted to just be a kid again, it felt like after that, my childhood was over. I had to always carry this with me and feel responsible, and neither my grandma nor my mom ever brought it up again. I always wondered how they felt about it, whether they blamed me, whether they thought it was just a terrible accident or just negligence, something that couldn't be helped. I brought it with me throughout my life, and even to this day, I'm 34 and have nightmares about my great-grandma Helen. They're usually about her body being put somewhere and people starting to discover it, and then I have to move it like I am trying to cover up a crime. That's just what my brain conjures constantly. And I do feel guilty that if it weren't for me, she might have lived a little bit longer. I don't know how much longer, but she deserved to have a nurse tending to her, not a 12-year-old kid who didn't want to be there, who avoided her, who was afraid of her. It just felt very unfair to both of us. I had no business being there, and she had no choice. She was just as much a victim as I was, and she had to pay the ultimate price for us not having the money to give her the care that she needed. And I wish that she had. I've talked a bit about my time with my great-grandmother in therapy and have been told many times that, of course, it wasn't my fault. I was just a kid. I can't be held responsible. And I'd really like to feel that way. I want to be able to forgive myself. And I'm hoping to get to the point where it's not something I carry along with me, but something that I can find peace with and accept. I'm not there yet, but I feel like I'm taking steps in the right direction.
Wasted on the floor again, and no one seems to mind. I could go back out, and that would take too much time. I'm still busy calling out your name wide-eyed and face down on the pine. And how I miss the colors of the leaves that grow in spring. How you used to dance upon the rain, and I would sing. And how I'd give most anything to watch you twirl around for one more time. I need more time. I need more time.
This is Risk. This is Adam Melkor behind me now, and we just heard from Sam D. I'll tell you, I was so moved by Sam's honesty in the way she told that story. I'll never forget how the film director, Todd Haynes, was asked why he didn't put a tidy, happy ending on the movie Safe. And he said something like, "It's not really fair to the characters that an author has created to saddle them with an entirely positive or even an entirely negative ending. Because the truth is, most of us don't heal 100% from things or even get to a eureka moment that forever fixes our mindset about something. Processing the most emotional things that happen to us can be a long and winding and sometimes confusing journey. Sometimes it's one step forward, two steps back. you know, no matter how tempted we might be to simplify things and just say, oh, we found the answer or we turned the corner, I'll tell you, lately, I've been struggling with the fact that a breakup that I went through in March of 2023 has started hurting for me in a big way all over again now that summer is here. And I remember how devastated sunshiny days made me feel last year at this same time. I mean, can you imagine finding beautiful weather extremely painful? And then there are times I get down on myself for not being quote-unquote over it, as they say, you know? So I'm grateful to Sam for sharing so honestly about where she really is at on her journey towards self-compassion. And that journey is an ongoing thing. And Sam is a founding member of Cleveland's Imposters Theater, the home for alt comedy, improv, and sketch. And you can find her at Are You My New Dad on Instagram.
We'll be right back. We're back.
Folks, on Thursday, we have the Best of Father's Day Stories number 2 on account of, you know, Father's Day. But that's coming soon. And folks, today's the day. Take a risk.
Shrapnel of my faith in you is cutting through my skin. Somewhere in the mess around my body begins. And I don't see an end to this.